cord and keep going. So, so when we settle into the mind, we can be startled by what's going on inside of the mind and the body. The body can be all stressed out. The mind can be a whole inner mob. There can be a lynch mob in there. There can be a mob that's demanding action, or a mob that's in debate between quitting our job and keeping our job, staying in a relationship, leaving a relationship, calling up a friend and telling them off, or not calling up a friend and telling them off. There can be a, there can be parliament in there. Have you ever watched the English Parliament? I love that stuff. So the mind can be, the mind can be a mess. And it's no wonder then that we spend so much of our lives racing around in the external world, because part of us can at times know what happens when we stop and we try to settle down. There can be this, I've known people who said to me, oh, I can't meditate, I can't even really stop. When I come to a stop, I don't really like what's going on inside there. It's very sad state, but it's a state that all of us at one point or another, many points or another in our lives, wind up where we don't feel comfortable with what's going on inside of us. So the Buddha, ever a man of lists, if there's one thing the Buddha could do beyond explain stress and suffering, it is also he could make a list. He has books and books and books of lists. In fact, one book is the numbered discourses is just lists of lists. So, but they're helpful. And the Buddha broke down these states that make us so uncomfortable, that get in the way of our inner calm. And they are known as the hindrances, the five hindrances. Pancha Nivaranani. Pancha means five, and Nivaranani means obstructions or hindrances. The things that keep us from feeling comfortable. The things that when we start to meditate feel really make our inner experience trying. So I'm going to go through them and talk about what they are, why they're important, and what we can do about them. And if you've been to my talks, that's pretty much all I ever do, which is say why we should think about something and then what to do about it. So no surprise there. So the first of the five hindrances is lust and craving, that state of wishing we had something or someone, that feeling that there's something missing in our lives. And if only I had that one thing, if only I had that relationship, if only I had that better apartment. There's this feeling that there really, we have this feeling that there really is something missing, but in fact the brain is just set up to jump from one craving item to the next. We might feel, oh, I'll be really complete when I get that digital camera. Then we get that digital camera, and then before we know it, we're craving something else. It could be a job or whatever. It could be, you know, eating dinner after Dharma Punks. It can be a small craving or it could be a big craving. And the thing about sensual pleasure cravings is that, in general, the amount of time we spend thinking about it and causing ourselves stress over the payoff is an enormous imbalance. For example, think about the amount of time that people spend craving dinner versus the amount of time that the food is actually on your tongue and you're actually tasting it. Or an even better one is think of the amount of time that people think about getting laid versus how long sex actually generally lasts. We might spend twice as many hours thinking about a vacation and what we're going to do in that vacation and how we're going to be when we get to that beach. And then when we get to the beach, you're there for an hour and a half and you want to go back to the hotel or whatever. There's this imbalance in life where we spend so much time in the story about getting something. I was talking recently about the one of my favorite psychological terms, male sexual overperception, which those of you who were here last week know means it's just a psychological term for the fact that men think women want to sleep with them more than they actually do. Men interpret little gestures, little smiles, little, you know, and they go off into these long internal dialogues about how a smile means that this woman that they've just met is interested. There's nothing funnier than being with a guy at an establishment where people are expected to smile, like in a restaurant, and a waitress might come up, if it's a waitress and not a waiter, and the waitress comes up and smiles and says, "What can I get you?" And the guy says, "Oh, see." You might say, "Well, you know, she is in fact just doing her job, and part of her job is making you feel welcome. In fact, there's really nothing that you could tell whatsoever from the fact that she just smiled from you." And here's what's interesting. The guy you're with might acknowledge that and go right back into the story. There's something interesting about these hindrances, which is that we might even, to a certain degree, know we're in it, but they're so powerful, they suck us right back in sometimes. So the Buddha, for these five hindrances, used an analogy for each. And for lust, he said that when the mind is calm, it's like a pool of water that's clear. It reflects everything in the sky beautifully, and it shows everything inside of it clearly. That's what the mind is like when it's calm and tranquil. And each of these five hindrances do something that disturbs this pool of water. In the case of lust and craving, it's like pouring red dye in the water. It makes everything inside of the water seem red. It makes the sky that it reflects look red. And that's the same thing with a guy who thinks that a woman's is, you know, in that place of lust or craving. He'll take any little thing and turn it into a story of, "See, she's interested in me." So when we are in lust and craving, it completely filters the way we view the world. We might even be partially aware of it, but still it will distort reality, distort everything that we experience. Now, the second hindrance is exactly the opposite. It's the state of aversion. It's when we really think, if only I could get rid of that one person, that one thing in my life, that one coworker, that one boss, that roommate, that difficult situation, that if only that one thing in my life wasn't here, if only I could get rid of that person, then everything would be fine. And of course, when we go back in our lives and we reflect on both aversion and craving, if we can reflect, we see that generally in our lives, when we've gotten the things we've wanted, or we've gotten rid of the things we didn't want, the relief is very short. We almost invariably go on to another thing that we're craving and another person that we are unhappy with. In every job I've ever worked at, there's always been people who sit and talk about that one person that they can't stand. And when that one person moves on to another job, they find someone new. Because people, when they're in a gossiping state, they basically need a scapegoat. This need to either push away or cling predates the objects that we attach to. In other words, we like to think, oh, if only that person was my friend, or if only I could get rid of this person in my life, everything would be fine. My life would be easier, my job would be easier, my roommate situation would be easier. But if we reflect back in our lives, any time we get rid of somebody we don't like or we get somebody that we do like, the long-term results for our happiness is generally nowhere near as great as we predicted before we got what we wanted. So it's important to realize that these states, in essence, are there before the objects that they affix themselves to. We have underlying lust and underlying aversion before we affix it to somebody that we like or somebody that we don't like. The third state that we might find when we look within is boredom, or tiredness, or sleepiness, or drowsiness. Sometimes they translate this they translate it from Pali to torpor, which is a word I've never said in my entire life. So I don't know why they are so fixed with torpor. But basically, it's that state of underlying feeling overwhelmed, sluggish, unmotivated, just completely, you know, without any energy, unengaged. If you went to a psychiatrist, this is the kind of state when it's in a very profound state that generally people get prescribed Wellbutrin for, because Wellbutrin is dopamine and it fires up the brain, gives the brain energy. So this is one state that we often might find, the state of being in a dull fog and bored by life and not engaged and sluggish and low in energy. The fourth state is the exact opposite. It's a state of being agitated and worried, free-floating anxiety, the mind jumping around. There's so much I've got to do. There's so many things I should be thinking about. What am I doing sitting here in a fucking cushion in a room filled with other freaky, you know, people? Oh, I don't know what I'm doing here. Why did I leave work? There was a million things. There's probably an email. There's five emails. There's somebody probably Facebooked me. What am I doing here? This is awful. One thing to stop. I've got to get back to my life. That kind of energy, and that's of course, the kind of energy that when you go to a sympathetic psychiatrist, they're going to slam you with serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, to clamp down the amount of dopamine you got firing all those thoughts so that your brain will feel a little bit more calm. Now, it's important that just like psychiatrists will tell you, there's very rarely one person who fits into any single mode. We almost all of us have all of these different hindrances. Sometimes we're sluggish and bored, and there's nothing more uncomfortable than the state of being bored. We, as a culture, we feel boredom is like is there's something inherently wrong with it. We're not patient with boredom at all. We don't like to work with it. And then on the other points, we might be extremely anxious and worried about a million different things. And then we might fall into craving for something like, oh, I'll feel better if I could just get something to eat right now, and I, you know, or I would feel better if only that roommate of mine just wasn't home when I get there. So we can jump around through all these four hindrances. The fifth and the final hindrance is doubt. And this is doubt in the sense of doubting that there is true happiness, doubting that there is a way to find inner peace, and also doubting that even if there is a way, that we'll be the ones who will be allowed to see and experience it. Sometimes it's just doubt. There's nobody who's peaceful. I don't know what this guy's talking about. He's got a lot of tattoos. He says that he's peaceful, but he's probably not. And all these other people who say that they're peaceful, they're not. It's just a ruse. Or B, well, yeah, he might be peaceful, but I'll never be peaceful because all this stuff, like when I try to meditate, it just never works out. I'll never be calm. So that's doubt. The five, when we're in lust, it's like the water is filled with red dye. When we're in aversion or hating someone, it's like the water's boiling, and it's disturbing the look of everything in it. When we are in tiredness and boredom, the water, the Buddha said, was filled with algae and murkiness, so you can't see what's in it. When we are filled with anxiousness and worry and anxiety, he says it's like the water in our mind is being whipped up by a wind that creates all this rippling in the water. And finally, doubt, he said, is just nighttime. Just nighttime, just darkness. You can't even see what's in the water. It could be a storm passing over. So, in each case, when we're in the hindrances, it completely disturbs the way we experience everything in the world. We no longer perceive things correctly. When we're in craving, we're not paying attention to anything but that thing we're craving. When we're in aversion, we're not paying attention to all the good things in our lives or even the good things about that person we're angry with. We're just focused on how much we can't stand that one person. When we're in anxiety and worry, we're not in any way capable of thinking or relaxing and reflecting on calming thoughts, etc., etc., etc. So these are states that we fall into, and they really affect the way we experience our lives. On top of that, all of these five states have something in common, which is they are stressful. They are all stressful. When we are in lust, it might feel pleasurable to, I just love thinking about how much I want to be with that person. It's so nice. But actually, when you're in lust, you don't realize it, but your hypothalamus is pumping out stressors. Cortisol is rushing through your body. In all of these states, your mind, because you're so uncomfortable and the mind is contracted, is releasing stressors. And there's some interesting things that happen to the body when we are in stress. The blood pressure rises, our blood sugar level increases. When we're stressed out, often when we're worried at work or constantly feeling like we're behind and anxious, stress actually attacks a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is how you store your memories. Long-term stress, it's been shown, causes Alzheimer's disease and memory loss. It's actually, the stress hormones actually release a kind of amino acid that attacks the hippocampus, which is why they've shown that people are more likely to suffer from dementia and Alzheimer's disease if they've lived in with long-term stress. It also releases gastric acid, which makes it much more difficult for you to digest your food. You stop producing T cells, which is what fights infections and helps your body immune system, and your body instead is producing red blood cells, because when you're stressed out, your body thinks you're about to be in a fight. So it's just creating red blood cells to help you repair the body. Anyway, the more they do research on stress, trust me about it, the more profoundly they discover how many deaths and how many lives are adversely affected by stress. Stress is just an incredibly dangerous thing to play around with over long periods of time. So this practice, all the Buddhist teachings, boil down to relieving stress, reducing stress in our lives. Not only so that we can achieve lasting happiness, but as a byproduct also so that physically and mentally we can live more comfortably. So what do we do? How do we know when we're falling into these states and how can we fight them? The first thing is that when you're falling into a hindrance, the first thing that's going to happen is your breath's going to change slightly. You're not going to have a very slow, calm, relaxed, comfortable breath. The problem is most people aren't aware what's going on with their breathing. But if you check when you're anxious, when you're caught up in some form of discomfort, your breath has become more clipped. It's the rhythm has slightly changed from the long, slow, even pace breath. Of course, a secondary level is that in the body, there's areas where we hold stress. I've talked about this virtually every week, but each one of us has a place in their body where we carry our stress. Some of us have two or three places. Some people feel stressness at the base of their throat. Some people feel stress and their stomach gets tight, or their chest gets contracted, or their shoulders go up, or their jaw starts moving and clenching. You each have your own areas, and it's up to you to determine where you carry stress and be aware when you are falling into one of these hindrances. On top of that, the mind becomes what the Buddha called a tamayaka. The mind becomes more claustrophobic. We don't notice what's going on around us. We're not fully aware anymore. We tend to be captivated by specific thoughts. And there's just an overall change in the way we are interacting with the rest of the world. We tend to be a little bit more distant, a little bit more hard to reach, or we might be frantic, or we might be in a very reactive, defensive state. So those are some of the ways you can tell. I generally find that the breath is, you know, not the easiest way. For me, I can always tell when I'm falling into a hindrance by just checking my stomach. For me, that's the great tell. When I'm getting worked up about something, I always lose about an inch of waist. And for me, you know, it's like, I got a stomach here. But I mean, yeah, my stomach just gets really taut when I'm working myself up about something. And it's very helpful to become aware of that key so that when you are in stress, when you're worked up about something, you can start to first relax the breath, ask yourself what kind of breathing would feel good now, then breathe into the part of your body that's gotten tight, relax it, then make sure that your mind is as open as you can. Start to make sure you're hearing what's going on around you, you're seeing what's going on around you. Make your mind as, don't allow your mind to contract. So, I'm going to now briefly talk about what we can do about when we're in each of the five. And there's so much you can do that would be a very long talk, so I'm just going to give you some very highlights. When we are craving someone, when we are male sexual overperception or female sexual overperception or just in lust or craving, the Buddha had some very funny, wise things. But one of the things he recounted over and over again is to reflect on really like what a human body is that we're craving. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's basically a lot of skin that's covering a lot of organs. And you know, it belches, it farts, it shits, and it grows old and it grows sick and it dies. And if you find yourself just like completely preoccupied about somebody, right? There's any number of things you can imagine or reflect on. I mean, they too, you know, fart, shit, grow old, get sick. They too, you know, have organs inside of them. They too have all the mildly repellent things about a body that everybody has. Everybody's body has wonderful things about it. A body is a miracle, but it also has its drawbacks. And we tend to forget that and only focus on the very appealing external parts. And we don't like to think what will happen to that person in 5, 10, 15 years from now. And it's just important to reflect on that because you can still enjoy and be very happy with their company, but you don't want to have your awareness completely captured by lust and craving so that you're unaware of what's going on in your life right here and now. If the other person that you're daydreaming about is not here and right now, It's not a very effective use of your mind. In fact, all it's doing is causing stress. It's not bringing really any lasting pleasure. It's a pleasure that's very conditional. So, also the Buddha talked about just simply reflecting that whenever we crave something, someone, some sensual pleasure, be it dinner, be it whatever, a coat, shoes, you know, whatever it is we're craving, new Macintosh. In general, whenever we've gotten it in the past, it hasn't solved all our problems. Just reflect that, oh, okay, actually, whenever I get the things I really want, in general, my peace of mind for getting something external lasts for only a brief time. It's actually not worth all the mental energy generally that we put into it. There's nothing wrong with having goals. There's nothing wrong with wanting a relationship, wanting a new apartment, wanting a new Macintosh. But thinking about it constantly and causing stress when you could be using your mind so much more effectively is not necessary. You still will probably wind up with that Macintosh and that apartment. Or you won't. But either way, those things were never going to bring you lasting peace of mind or happiness. Now, one of my favorite ones is when we are in anger or hatred or aversion with someone. The Buddha offered us a couple of very wonderful tools. For example, reflecting on some of the positive things that person does. Most of the time we just get caught up and we might want to get in a subway, somebody's standing right in front of us, we don't know who they are, and we might get caught up in this, oh, how could somebody be so stupid, standing right in front of the subway door, I have to get in here. And it's very tempting to think, oh, that person's such an idiot, blah, 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 and turn that one little momentary thing where we could have just walked out of our way into 5 minutes of inner diatribe. Now, we can cut that diatribe short by simply reflecting, well, that person probably has a difficult job that they have to work to. They're probably exhausted. They might not have gotten a lot of sleep. They're probably not consciously choosing to make my life a little bit more difficult. And God knows what they've been through. So, reflecting on the story around the singular little part that we tend to hyper-focus on to get a bigger picture of the story. There have been times in my own life where I thought my own father was such a difficult pain in the ass. I grew up with a guy who was a drunk, and he could be very selfish. And years after, many, many years later as an adult, I met many, many people that my dad helped. And I realized that although in my own little corner of the world view of my disappointments with my dad, I really didn't take the time to notice or even just conceive of the idea that there might have been people that he actually was helping, that there was an entirely other story to my father than what I was seeing. And actually it completely changed the way I interacted with him and completely helped me get to a point where I could do the next skillful thing, which is practice forgiveness. Forgiveness is easier than we think. We don't let someone off the hook when we forgive them. All we do is try to get them out of our thoughts. So when I forgive you for doing something that I think is stupid or insulting, I'm not saying that it's okay. I'm not saying that I'm not going to sue you. I'm not saying any of that. I'm simply saying I don't want to think about you anymore. And how do I do that? I reflect on times when I've done something inconsiderate. And I ask for forgiveness for myself and my thoughts. And then I say, just as I have forgiven myself for doing this or have asked forgiveness for being inconsiderate, so too do I forgive this person. Again, none of us are powerful enough to actually get anybody off the hook. And finally, the third biggest tool in that arsenal is karma. Knowing that everybody has to live in their actions, the result of their actions. I don't have to play judge, jury, and executioner for anyone, because if somebody has acted really shitty towards me, they have to live in that shitty little mind. And that's just it. We live in the results. We live in the mind that we create. If we create a mind that is judgmental and harsh and vindictive, then we live in that mind. If somebody acts critical, vindictive, mean-spirited, they have to live in that mind. And I guarantee you, they're not only turning those actions towards you, they're also turning those thoughts and actions on themselves. That's the way the mind works. The mind doesn't just think mean thoughts out there and nice thoughts inside. It's not the way the mind works. So if somebody acts like a shit towards you, guess what? They're living in a shitty little mind right now. So you don't have to get yourself worked up about what you're going to tell them, which you probably never will, because we never say the things that we promise we're going to say at 2 o'clock in the morning, do we? Most of the times we don't. Okay. Finally, rushing through, because I can tell I've already reached the saturation point. But if you are in tiredness in your meditation, the Buddha had some wonderful advice like standing up, opening the eyes. And my favorite, though, is holding the breath, which will wake you up really quickly. I was in one of the dullest retreats with a monk who I could tell had fallen asleep. A wonderful Ajahn who had fallen asleep, and I was sitting there with my mind about to go off too. You know, it was raining outside, and I could tell that the Ajahn had fallen asleep, and I just held my breath, and it woke me right up. On the other hand, sometimes in a situation you might want to fall asleep, so you might not want to do that. Now, if in a larger sense we're feeling bored or complacent or not any energy in our practice, or the Buddha talked about reflecting on that life is short and that suffering and stress is real, that we only have a very short period of time to practice and to achieve inner peace. It takes a lot of work. So if we find that there's, when we sit down and there's this lethargy or this inability to get the mind motivated, to reflect, really, look at the people in our lives that are stressed out. See the effects that worry and stress and agitation has on the people around us. Ask yourself, is that what you want? My dad, who gave up his meditation practice, spent the last days of his life where he was completely falling apart and going through the process of dying, asking me when he was awake often how the stock market was doing, because his mind was still wrapped up in craving and insecurity. He didn't have any, he had let go of that peace that he had cultivated. So it's really important to see what happens if we don't start early and work towards this very noble goal, which is finding an inner place where the mind can reside comfortably. So no matter what's going on in your life, and there will be shitty things that go on in life, that's the nature of it, you will have a place that you've built where you can reside peacefully. That's an incredibly virtuous goal. There is no, I can think of a few greater goals. So when we're in worriness and anxiousness, that's the time really to work with the breath. Really have a kind of breathing that you know can relax you and bring you into the body. Scan through your body. Find the places where you carry anxiousness and worry and stress. And after you've found a comfortable breath, relax those places. Finally, when it comes to working with doubt, a really important thing is to watch your meditations and to see how certain thoughts and certain practices pay off. They might not pay off immediately, but you'll notice over time in your practice that, in fact, when you do meditate, even if it's only 5 minutes a day, you will notice a qualitative difference in the way you react to other people, the amount of stress, how calm you are, than in the rest of your lives. Another way we do this, at the end of every Dharma Punks, we do the metta meditation, where we think thoughts like, may I be peaceful, may I be free from stress and suffering. And then after we do this, we just notice what those thoughts do to the body. Just observing that practice works can help so much build up a sense of confidence that our spiritual lives are worthwhile. That trying to lead ourselves to a stress-free condition is worth the effort we put in. So those are the five hindrances, why they're important, and ways to work with them. Now is your turn to ask any questions about any of this, and I thank you so much for coming tonight. Hi.